You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Now to our series with the BBC, Six Routes to Riches, a look at the challenges and opportunities people face as they make a living around the world. We've toured six countries at the heart of the changing global economy. This week in our final segment, the United States. And yeah, we all know the phrase, the American dream. And in our series, we found the people from other countries use that phrase as a marker for their own mobility, their path to the middle class. So we sent Marketplace's Chrissy Clark to a place that, in many ways, embodied the American dream. A birthplace of tech innovation that shapes our lives, a place where inventors with nothing but a hunch about a new way to solve a problem founded startups that made them fabulously wealthy. You know the place I'm talking about. It's a little valley known as
the Miami River Valley. You know, where Dayton, Ohio is?
Right. Exciting. No doubt about it. Dayton is an up, up and away kind of place.
Okay, maybe that's not the valley that jumps immediately to mind as the hub of innovation in America. But stay with me, and with this Dayton promotional video from 1968.
The drive to innovate, shared by all Daytonians.
And let us try to convince you that if Silicon Valley has a prototype, it is Dayton, Ohio. In the early 20th century, Dayton had the most patents per capita of any American city. It was also
home to one of the world's greatest concentrations of scientists.
Maybe you've heard of the Wright brothers, those self-taught engineers who never went to college. Very Silicon Valley, right? Well, Wilbur and Orville designed and built their airplanes in, you got it, Dayton, Ohio. But that is just the beginning.
You can hardly get through a day today in 2015 without having a connection to Dayton, Ohio.
Alex Heckman toured me through the historical museum he runs in Dayton that has literally hundreds of early technological inventions on display.
So here we go.
The cash register. The pop top on a can of soda. Air conditioning.
Magnetic strip technology for credit cards.
Stealth technology for aircraft.
Barcode scans.
Batteries used on satellites.
ATM machines.
Thermal printing on like a receipt from a gas station pump.
Scratch and sniff stickers.
Okay, so you're getting the picture, right? And then there's that whole come up with something world-changing in a garage thing that Silicon Valley loves to brag about. Well, before there were garages in Silicon Valley where Hewlett and Packard and Jobs and Wozniak tinkered, there was this place in Dayton.
So this, we're standing in the original carriage house known as Deeds Barn.
A wooden barn with an old Cadillac inside. This is where, back in the 19-teens, a couple of Ohio farm boys from modest means, Edward Deeds and Charles Kettering, tried to solve one of the biggest and most important problems that had ever faced the auto industry. How to start a car without having to kneel down in the mud and crank it by hand.
They sometimes would work for 36 hours in a row. And there's a story of Kettering literally falling asleep out of exhaustion underneath the car.
Eventually, they figured it out. I'll let one of the inventors, Charles Kettering, explain, or the animatronic version of him that's part of the museum's exhibit.
He's making eye contact with me right now.
He's very, very lifelike.
Anyway, I'll let him explain.
In this barn, we've perfected something that will make it possible for anyone to start a car. It's our Delco self-starter.
The self-starter went on to make these two Ohio farm boys a lot of money. They sold the company they started in this barn to General Motors. And when Charles Kettering died in 1958, he was worth $350 million. But I have to say, self-starter is also a pretty good metaphor for the spirit that was alive all over Dayton back in the early to mid-20th century. Not just for inventors, but for the thousands and thousands of people who found jobs right in Dayton, mass-producing all these new things that were being invented. And I feel like this part needs another swell of that cheesy Dayton promotional video music. Thank you.
It's a situation where success breeds success.
Alex Heckman, the guy at the History Museum, says in the same way that people now flock to Silicon Valley to make it in the tech boom, back then people flocked to Dayton to climb out of poverty and make it into the middle class.
Someone could pull themselves up by their bootstraps by going to work for a major manufacturing facility, moving from some poor rural community in
central Kentucky, landing a job at the Cash.
That was the nickname for the cash register factory.
And creating a nice life for yourself, for your family, a nice home.
All these people working at all these factories making
automobile parts, refrigerators, air conditioners, electronic data processors.
And making a good living. But, of course, you probably knew this was coming. Alex says, as proud as he is when he walks through his own museum exhibits that pay homage to all Dayton's factories and innovation and Fortune 500 companies.
You also look at it and think, gosh, you know, these companies are all gone.
December 23rd, 2008 was our last day to work. That was our Christmas present from General Motors.
James Hudson worked at a GM plant in Dayton for 17 and a half years. And in that time, he climbed into the middle class. In the last years before he lost his job, he was making
with benefits and everything, according to the little thing they sent home, I was making $49 an hour.
Minus the benefits, that was about $21 an hour. Still pretty good for a guy who never went to college. Those high wages were part of the reason GM pulled out of Dayton. They could find labor much, much cheaper in other parts of the world. But those high wages were also what kept James Hudson and his family, and the Dayton economy, and the whole American economy beyond that, running.
We was living comfortable.
Living comfortable, like we had vacation every summer. Yeah. We had like...
That other voice you hear is James's son, Adam, who's now 22 and has a baby boy of his own. These days, the Hudson's life pre-factory shutdown seems like a distant memory.
Like if we wanted to go out and do something, we could afford it. We wanted to go to the movies, we could afford it. Wanted to buy some new toys for Adam, we could afford it. They didn't do it, but we could have. Yeah.
Since then, life has been very different for the Hudson family. You might say they're downwardly mobile. For a while, James, the dad, got unemployment and some severance pay. But then that all ran out. He almost lost his house.
It was a struggle, but I know how to do all kinds of stuff. So did many flea markets, did many garage sales, worked on people's cars. Anything I get a hold of that I know I can make a dollar on, I work to get what I got. If I lose it, you know, it's my fault because there's too many other ways to make a dollar.
Eventually, James went back to school to become an electrical lineman, but he's still not making as much as he made at the GM factory. As for his son, Adam, after his dad got laid off, to help out with money, Adam dropped out of high school and started working.
I think I actually cried the day that I dropped out, but I was trying to help him out as best I could.
Though, without a high school degree, most of the jobs Adam can get only pay $8 or $9 an hour. He's worked at Walmart, Target,
McDonald's, Steak and Shake, Bob Evans. I worked a third shift job cleaning the Regal Theater in Beaver Creek for quite a while.
Another of the things working against Adam is that he doesn't have a reliable way to get to work. Public transit in the Dayton suburb he lives in is nearly non-existent. And ironically, the son of a guy who used to make cars can't afford one.
Losing jobs, finding jobs, losing jobs again because I can't get to work, because I can't make enough money to get a car, because I keep running into bills, because I can't get to work. I guess you could say it's kind of been downhill gradually.
Still, amazingly, Adam has this undeniable optimism about his future. I visited him recently at his sister's house.
Would you like lemonade?
He's been sleeping on her couch for the last few months.
Is this your bed?
Kind of.
And before he headed out to work, his latest job is making dough at Little Caesars. We sat down for a few minutes. He opened up his can of soda using that Dayton-born pop-top technology and wanted to show me something on his phone. It was a pep talk he'd written a couple of months ago when he was feeling especially horrible.
Will you read it?
Yes. It says, you're the only one who can change your destiny, the only one who can find your purpose in this world. No one to hold your hand or pick you up. You must pick yourself up time after time and dust yourself off because you're the one who's going to do this. You're the one who's going to win this battle. You're the one who's going to make you happy, and others may be there to help you, but you're the one who has to do this, not them. So get up, get ready, and show them how it's done because you can do this.
And with that, he went outside, did a backflip.
Little low, but it's morning. It's
morning. Wow. And headed off to work.
Thanks, Chrissy. We've been talking so much about mobility and the American dream in this series. What did Adam say to you about the American dream?
Well, why don't we just play his clip? Here's what he said.
Well, I mean, from what I've heard from TV and the internet and everything else, the American dream is basically have a great job, great family, great house, great everything.
But sadly, the outlook for Adam Hudson achieving the American dream, at least in his terms, is not so great in a place like Dayton, Ohio. There's been some Harvard economists who've been looking at economic mobility and how it differs in different parts of the U.S. They wanted to see if they can find any patterns about what drives mobility in a particular region. And while back in its heyday, Dayton had pretty good mobility, when you could get these middle-class jobs at factories, in recent years, Dayton has some of the worst rates of economic mobility in the country. Only about 5% of kids who grow up in poor working-class families make it into the top of the income ladder by the time they're in their 30s. And this isn't just about the economy in Dayton. You know, it actually has fairly low unemployment rates. But researchers have found that things like economic segregation in the community, basically how much poor and middle-class people are bumping into each other in a day-to-day way, things like poor schools, those things have a lot to do with the poor rates of economic mobility in Dayton, Ohio, and the area.
That's Chrissy Clark reporting from Dayton, Ohio, really the Silicon Valley of the last century. And I'm going to pick it up from here because I went to Silicon Valley, which it turns out has the highest rate of upward mobility of any metro area in the country. According to that same Harvard study, let's say you start in the bottom fifth in San Francisco or San Jose, you've got about a 12% chance of reaching the top fifth. And in the Bay Area, a lot of moving up can mean moving into the tech industry. This is TJ Ransom. TJ's 19. He grew up in the East Bay with his photographer mother. He paints gorgeous pictures and always thought of himself as more artist than techie. But when he got a chance to peek inside some of the big companies, that shifted.
You know, when I was at Facebook, we had a panel of people who were talking to us, and I just asked, what kind of jobs are there for designers? Because I do graphic design. I'm just like, I have no idea how I could fit into this. Oh, there's so much. There's absolutely so much. And they started naming off, just how Facebook looks and how often that changes. Designers are behind that. It was really comforting to hear there's a place in tech industry that I can fit.
Making TJ, who is Black, and other people like him fit in the often white, Asian, and male tech world is part of the plan at Hack the Hood, a tech and advocacy organization where TJ learned web design. He built sites for businesses sort of like his mom's, an Oakland-based photography studio. One of his clients sold crystals and tarot cards. Hack the Hood taught him coding, but also about leveraging Silicon Valley's diversity problem as a potential opportunity. When you take Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Yahoo, Google, and eBay, the portion of their U.S.-based tech workers who are either Black or Latino are roughly 3-4%.
The more people we can get to say, hey, I'm interested and I have the skills, then the less of an excuse that, these tech companies will have for having a lack of diversity.
And since the mantra of Silicon Valley seems to be about finding entrepreneurial opportunities everywhere, teaching even younger students the skills for tech jobs is itself a business. We went to the San Francisco headquarters of CodeHS, where two 25-year-old Stanford graduates, Zach Gallant and Jeremy Keeshan, sell online curricula to schools around the country. Here's Jeremy Keeshan.
Computer science is the highest paid college degree. There's two jobs for every graduate. There's a million jobs by 2020 that can't be filled. And meanwhile, 5% of schools teach AP computer science. 27 states had 6 or fewer Black students take AP computer science.
The thread that connects Keeshan and Gallant, Stanford, that's one of the keys to this whole thing. The valley, the entrepreneur chain, a path to prosperity, everything. And in the same way Chrissy got a tour in Dayton, we walked through Stanford's exquisite grounds from entrepreneur turned Stanford law professor, tech evangelist, and multiple hat wearer Vivek Wadhwa.
Welcome to Stanford.
He led us past a gorgeous courtyard, up an architect-designed staircase, and into a faculty lounge with both a breakfast spread and a grand piano. Stanford kind of feels like a farm team for Silicon Valley. For a college campus, this place reeks of money.
You're not kidding. I mean, and you go and hang out at the Trezor Student Union and start listening to what the students are talking about. And they're talking about starting companies. They're talking about venture capital.
But there's also another discussion going on. The day we were on campus, the student paper ran an article about how students who were not majoring in tech had a hard time looking for jobs, which echoes a larger conversation in Silicon Valley. Do you have to be a tech worker to have a good life? Median income for a tech worker is $118,000, but fully one-third of Silicon Valley workers earn less than $18 an hour, according to the group Working Partnerships USA. That's not enough to meet the basic standard of living. In a place like Dayton, that would be really good. But here, it means the traditional middle class feels lost. Math teacher Christine Holst at Pioneer High School in San Jose is stunned by what's happened in her hometown.
The prices of housing have become astronomical.
Holst and her husband, a sound engineer, make about $8,000 a month. They have a baby daughter. In most cities in America, they could stop renting and finally own a home.
Do you know anybody who, of your friends who doesn't work in tech who owns their own home?
I don't think so.
A lot of people have said, you know, Silicon Valley is the model for the American economy right now, or the future of the American economy. What does that make you think?
I am very grateful to live in this area. I think it has a lot to offer. I love my students and everything, but it's just, if everywhere were like the Silicon Valley, it would make me sad.
That wistfulness is a part of TJ Ransom's world, too. He's caught between the promise of the tech world and his obvious aptitude for it and the rising cost of living in the Bay Area. We met up with him in Oakland at the storefront where TJ's mom's business used to be. It's being moved down the street by a spice shop that sells gourmet sea salts and truffle oils. We walked down the block to see all the former black-owned businesses that used to be here.
You know, for different reasons or another, most of the black businesses are gone now, and my mom is the last one.
How does that make you feel? I mean, we spent this time with you. You showed us the websites you're working on. You're like split between these two worlds. You're showing us your mom's business and also the stuff you want to do online. That must be like a really weird collision of identities.
I don't feel any collision so far, mostly because I'm not actually in a position to be the ones who are, you know, making...
You're 19.
Right. There we go. Much... it's hard to see myself in that position when I'm, you know, not, you know, I'm not even close to there yet.
Part of why this is goes back to TJ's view about mobility. The American dream for TJ was about folks moving to America, not about him.
The American dream was more of a thing for people coming from out of the country to America. But actually having been here my whole life, you know, I've never really had a grasp on that. With everything I've gone through in terms of figuring out what I want to do and actually be able to do that for a living.
But he says his views have changed. He's still uncertain about what he'll do for a living. But living in the Bay Area, even with all its challenges, he has opportunities.